Hey there, you're listening to Season 3 of the Sales for Founders podcast, and I'm your host, Louis Nickel. This is the show that teaches you how to get just good enough at sales to find your first customers and grow a profitable business. Whether you're scared of doing sales, you aren't getting the results you need, or you just don't know where to start. Each week, I sit down with sales experts and successful founders to get you the actionable advice you need to move forward faster. This week, I'm super excited to have Nick Davies as my guest on the show. Nick is the co-founder and CEO of Dentally, a B2B SaaS business based in the UK. Nick and his co-founder did sales to bootstrap Dentally from nothing to over $2 million in annual recurring revenue. But getting there has not been the easiest of journeys. In this episode, Nick spills all the details on how Dentally found their first customers, how they struggled with and overcame slow initial growth to make it to where they are today, and how they're handling sales during this COVID-19 pandemic when all of their customers' businesses are closed. Nick, it's great to have you here today. Why don't you kick us off with a quick rundown of who you are and what Dentally does?
Yeah, so I'm Nick and one of the founders of Dentally. We launched Dentally back in 2014. Dentally is a patient management system for dental practices, and we're predominantly based in the UK, although we do have one or two overseas customers. In the last 6 years, we've been growing and, slowly to begin with, and then expanding, much more quickly in recent years. And yeah, hopefully we can go through what we did for the first few customers and what we learned from those. There's plenty of learnings that I wish I'd done differently.
Awesome. Do you mind giving us a quick breakdown of what the product actually does? So,
Dentally is a patient management system for dental practices. So that basically means that we handle everything to do with the patient and the patient's visit to a dental practice. So patient details, demographics, appointments, and all then the clinical charting, medical histories, and everything like that. So if you go to the dentist for a checkup, there'll be all the details around that, as well as sending you the appointment reminder to make sure you turn up to the dentist, and then handling the billing you afterwards.
Cool. And then just on the numbers side, do you want to give us an idea, if you can, of, team size, rough revenue milestones over the last couple of years, and maybe just a ballpark figure of, roughly how much a customer pays you? Are we talking $10, $100, $10,000? Roughly where are we, so that the listeners know what to expect?
Yeah, sure. So in our last financial year, we've just passed just over $2 million ARR. Which has been quite a big milestone for us. Typically, a customer will pay us $200 to $400 a month recurring revenue, but then a large part of our business is we do paid onboardings. So, when a new customer signs up with us, there'll be a $1,500 to $3,000 charge, depending on exactly what they want as a setup fee, and then the monthly subscription starts from then on in. So in terms of our revenue, it's a proportion of it is recurring revenue, a large portion of it is recurring revenue, but then obviously some of it is directly sales-led as well.
Cool. And did you mention team size there? I don't think so.
Sorry, yes. And we've started out with just me and my co-founder. So it was a founding team of two, and we're up to 18 at the moment, with people broken across various departments.
Brilliant. So I think where we'll probably start off with today's chat, because I know we want to talk about a couple of different things. There's the story of how you found those first customers and exactly, the process of how you grew from customer number one to customer number 10 and all the way up to where you are now. But you also had some interesting things to talk about regarding being in a period of things not working out too well and all of a sudden finding your feet and starting to grow quickly. And then towards the end, I do want to spend some time just talking about how you've been handling the sales and growth side of handling this kind of COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic and what effect that's had on your business. So maybe we can just dive in nice and simple at the beginning with where the idea for Dentally came from and what your process was from kind of thinking about that, I imagine, with a friend over a beer or something, and then going all the way from there to customer number one.
Yes, certainly. Yeah, many beers were had in the development of Dentally. My co-founder James and I were at university together, so we actually founded the business out of university. And James's the introduction to dentistry as an industry is that James's family are dentists, so we kind of like it was a classic experience of trying to help out a dentist, looking at what they'd got in terms of software, and then going out to market to buy better software because what we saw was pretty rubbish. We then quickly realized that the friends and family dental practices that we're speaking to were using the market leader. And at that point, we felt that, cool, this is a pretty good opportunity. So back in 2013, we a little bit naively, in hindsight, decided that we could do a better job, built an MVP that we launched to a private beta right at the end of 2013. And then by April 2014, we sort of publicly launched to no real fanfare at all. Then a little bit of a kind of like growth. Early days, it was a hard slog, and that was a combination of just early sales are hard work, but it's rewarding in just pushing through it, and also a couple of things that we certainly didn't help ourselves with. So by the end of 2014, 9 months after launch, we had 9 paying customers. A whole 9 customers. And then, we'd expanded that out to get our first 100 customers. It took us just over 2 and a bit years. So, it didn't come all overnight. It was a complicated journey. So one of the key things in our industry, in dentistry, is the fact that it is a B2B sales environment, but the dental practice and the owner isn't necessarily your traditional behind a desk person in business. They're typically inaccessible most of the day because they're in surgery treating patients. So you have very limited time to get hold of them. And overwhelmingly, they all use Hotmail, Gmail, Yahoo email accounts. So cold emailing is just impossible within dentistry. Essentially, those early day sales came from trying to build up a network of speaking to one dentist and then trying to extract out of them a couple of their colleagues' contact information, just doing it very, very, very manually. To that end, we then ended up setting a referral network, so where we would incentivize some of our really early customers to pass it on to, to introduce us to more of their dental practice colleagues.
Brilliant. Now, I want to dive in and spend a bit more time there in the very early stages, simply because a large portion of the audience who'll be listening today are technical people, probably developers, probably working in a full-time software development role, who for ages have wanted to go and start something of their own and are really struggling to find an idea or a pain to solve for customers that people will be happy to pay the money for. So it sounds to me, I'm kind of reading between the lines, and I'd love to get a bit more detail on this. It sounds like you were looking for something, looking for a business opportunity, at least. This wasn't serendipitous. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think it's a combination. So, like I said, we were at university. James and I, we were at university in London, in the UK, which is a rather expensive city to live in. When you're a student and you're having to spend multiple pounds on beer, it's expensive. So we started the business by looking for some more beer money, believe it or not. Originally, we were just trying to help out small businesses doing some tech support, anything that could come to us that was slightly more technical than working behind a bar. The reason we launched Dentally or started producing Dentally is because we saw the opportunity through supporting these other people. It's a classic case. There's a spreadsheet somewhere that is being used in business where a piece of SaaS would be a much more elegant solution. And it's trying to see that spreadsheet, trying to see that crappy piece of hacking together that a company's done to get it to work how they want. And in our case, it was, PMS, patient management systems in dental practices are commonplace, but that it's a very under-invested in industry. So we approached it early days and we were looking at it in providing some IT support to dental practices. And we really were just not enamored by the software that they were using, to the point where we actually went out to market to try and buy better software on their behalf. So we approached the market, but as a buyer, we didn't have the idea, oh, we can go and build Dentally out of this. It was, right, let's go and have a look what the best products are out there. quickly came to realize that these are the best products. And then at that point, it kind of, the idea was instilled upon us that, hang on, we might, using, you know, this modern technology, be able to make a SaaS out of this.
Brilliant. And do you mind taking me through like the, you know, the in detail, the in-depth story of exactly how you made that sale to that very first customer? I don't know if that was someone who necessarily was the very first person who agreed to pay you, but you know, who was the first person who you had, or the first company, the first dentist practice that you had kind of on record saying, yes, we are willing to give you some money for this, or we are willing to try this out?
Yeah. So one of the key things that I believe quite strongly in is, if you're providing value to someone, then you should be charging them. So don't be scared of charging people, or try to feel that you can give away your software for free that you've built. If you're providing them some value, then they should definitely pay for it. They can pay a nominal fee or something, but that psychological difference between them going, oh yeah, I'll use it and try it out for free, versus, oh yeah, I'll use it and I'll try it out and I'll open my wallet for you, I think is a key thing. So we went actually straight into this with our first initial beta customers were paying us some money, not a lot, and we did then grandfather their pricing for quite some time so that they benefited from being a very early customer. And we made that clear to them as well. So that was one of the things that we did early on, was we said, look, join us on this journey. Yes, you're going to be paying some money for it. We're not going to give it to you for free, but we will look after you going forward. And I think that was beneficial. Finding that first customer to pay us was a long, hard graft. It was just contacting people through networks. We'd speak to a dentist, and if they said that they were interested, then great. We'd kind of run through some of the details. When that didn't quite work out, we would then just completely say, look, okay, fine. We're really keen for this. We're founders of this business, you know, play on that. Hey, look, this is dynamic and enthusiasm of people jumping on the startup bandwagon. And then we just asked them to introduce us to a couple of their friends. That would then go through. And it was probably after having tens of these conversations that we found the first practice that was willing to kind of jump ship, so to speak, and launch a product. One of the key difficulties we have with selling dentally is the fact that it is the primary system that a dental practice will use to run their business. You know, if it doesn't work, they can't operate, they can't work. So we kind of like stop all of their revenue making abilities. It's a kind of fundamental to how they work. The flip side of that is it means that churn is very, very low.
Yeah, sure. I imagine that's a very difficult sales process to go through, to get people to trust you and to overcome their objections. For those first couple of customers, or you know, even that first those first one or two customers where you still really didn't have any proof at all that this worked well yet. You know, what did that sales process look like? Were you talking to them multiple times? Were you pitching up at their offices and asking for dental work in return for telling them about your product? What was happening there?
So yeah, there would be a combination of phone calls. We did try and just get out there and go and meet them and visit them. I think that certainly early stage, there's nothing wrong with going out and meeting people. Okay, depending on where you live, geography might get in your way. So this is not going to apply to all. But if you have that opportunity to find a local customer that fits who you're trying to target, definitely go out and visit them. Even if you're selling a lower value product, the amount that you would learn from that experience is huge. In addition to that, yeah, lots of them backwards and forwards on email after the meeting. And that probably brings me on to one of my key failures in the first 18 months of trying to sell dentally. You know, we were being a little bit all over the place. We hadn't quite settled down into doing things. And one of the things that we just didn't do, I personally didn't do as well as I should, is just follow up and follow up and follow up and follow up. I think there's absolute truth in what Steli from Closed.io says, which is, you just have to follow up until they say yes or tell you to fuck off. Because the easiest way for them to not make a decision is if you just stop hassling them and stop following up. So we just didn't do enough of that to begin with. And that I now realize was just leaving money, leaving opportunities on the table.
Yeah. And I think if there's one thing that's been consistent over the past, I don't know, 20 or so founders that I've interviewed, that would probably be the one piece of advice that was constant from everybody. That idea of having to follow up more than you expect to.
Absolutely. And, there are so many tools that you can automate a lot of this follow-up with. People, dentists, and I'm sure it's the same in other industries, are really good at getting really enthusiastic about something and then just totally ghosting you. So those are the kind of most demoralizing reasons why you can just not follow up. It's, you just can't do it. So 100% recommend just write a sequence, an email sequence, and use a tool that can send an email sequence through your Gmail or whatever. They're ghosting you a little bit. You've tried once, you tried twice. All right, throw them onto the sequence that's got maybe 6 or 7 emails in it. It sounds a lot, but the moment they reply, you can just take them out of the sequence and you can re-engage them. But at least you know that you're being able, you're following up with them without it completely eating away at you.
Yeah, for sure. And you moved on then, obviously, after those first couple of customers. It sounds like that was a long, hard, painful process. But you mentioned that after those initial first customers, you started using basically a referral network, so warm introductions to grow from there. Do you want to walk me through how exactly that worked?
Yeah, so we created the idea of a referral network where we'd give... you recommend someone to us, they sign up, we'll give you a 10% discount on your account. You refer another one, it's another 10%, and so on and so forth, to the point where theoretically someone could get Dentally for free. Turns out in a B2B environment, people aren't that engaged in saving money in that way. If you're running your own business, the idea of saving maybe 15 or 20 pounds, dollars a month is appealing, but not one that you're going to go out of your way to hunt down. So it did start working. And one of the benefits was we just got to speak to more people by doing this. So the referral, pushing for referrals and following up with our existing customers to introduce us to more people was incredibly successful. Incentivizing the referral didn't really work as intended. So fast forward 18 months or so, we actually pulled the referral incentivization program, but we're still getting referrals coming through. I think what we learned from that is you can't just copy what is out there on the internet and just blindly apply it. Keep an eye on what's going on, track it, and make sure that it was the incentivization program, if you're there, is doing it well. And like I said, we ran an experiment to pull the referral program and see what happened. And lo and behold, the referral rate just consistently carried on improving.
Brilliant. So I imagine that is, I guess we're looking at customers around, 20, 30, 40 at that point, maybe.
Yeah, about then. I think, the other thing to mention there is we intended the incentivization to be the reason that someone would refer. So if you take away that incentivization, you still need to give them a reason for them to refer people to you. And that is by just communicating with them, asking for it, going after them. Again, it's the follow-up after the sale and ensuring that you then maximize what's the next step. The idea of putting an incentivization program in a B2C environment is because you're then encouraging on your soliciting that referral by taking that away. We then had to make sure that we did it ourselves to solicit that referral. It doesn't happen naturally.
Right. Yeah, sure. Now, what I'd love to dive into a bit deeper there as well is just step by step what exactly that process looked like. So imagine you have a new customer coming in now, a new dentist practice that is going to sign up with you. How do you go from first approaching them for a warm introduction or a referral all the way through to that leading to another sale, basically? What does that cycle look like? Were you asking them for recommendations during the sales process after the onboarding? Were they doing the introduction themselves? Were you just, mentioning them in the introduction? What was happening there step by step?
Yeah, sure. So essentially the process we'd have is once we started speaking to a dentist, either that's one that reached out to us or that we'd engaged with, we do some old school stuff, like attending some trade shows and stuff like that in a very small way early days. You know, so anyone that we'd engage with through those, we'd obviously run through our sales process. And then once we close the sale, get them onboarded. And then during that onboarding process, given the fact that we do quite a hands-on onboarding process, we're then asking them there. Then we would typically ask about 6 months after they started being a customer to say, hey, have you managed to, you know, do you think any of your other colleagues would benefit from this, you know, and remind them about, you know, any university chums, because people that went to dental school, they typically have got quite a close-knit group, but they're not necessarily going to be the dentist down the road that they might fear is competing with them. You know, you've sold them this great benefit for their business. They don't want to tell their mate two doors down who's then going to have the same competitive advantage. So, you know, it's taking that angle there. And it was just a case of, yeah, just asking for them on a regular basis. Similar to the mistake we made with the follow-up early doors, we just weren't doing enough of this to begin with. You know, there was more referrals that we could have gone and extracted out of people purely by asking than we were doing. It doesn't take much to put a reminder in your CRM or whatever you're using to track this kind of stuff, or even in just Google Calendar, to contact this person 3 months in the future.
Sure. And once you had that referral, once you talked to a dentist and they'd said, oh yes, a friend from uni who's, I don't know, up in Nottingham, sounds like a great fit. What was the process there? Would you then reach out on their behalf? Would you ask them to connect you?
So initially we would reach out. We would try to get them to just send an email to us, to them, and CC us in. Very simple, classic, just get a CC. Primarily because, again, trying to get them to divulge their friend's information to a third-party company is sometimes challenging. So by doing that, they were doing it in an intro, here, just you two, I think you two should speak. And that's by far the most successful way. The other way would be just to push them to get their mate to reach out to us. Trying to get contact information from them for us to reach out to the third party, yeah, just didn't work.
Right, okay.
Because they would inevitably say, okay, yeah, fine, I just need to go and ask their permission first before I give you my contact details. And by that point, you may as well just ask them to CC you in on an email.
Sure, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then from that point, and I appreciate this, it may seem like I'm kind of, getting into the detail here, but I think
there are so many
people listening who have just never done this before, and they just can't visualize what even, you know, making some sales looks like. So if you don't mind going into a bit more detail about it, then I would ring them up and we would talk about this and, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
That so level of granularity.
Early days. So when I was doing founder sales, someone would reach out to us, or we'd get an inquiry or a phone number, something like that. The first thing that we would try to do is we'd make a phone call straight away. If you can have an initial phone call to begin with, you can really gain a sense of what the other person is after. And they get the, you know, the feeling that they can talk to you. And do not underestimate the power of founder sales. I think that's a huge advantage that founders have got over anyone working in sales that's not a founder. You've got far more credibility purely by your job title, irrespective of whether or not you've earned it. So inquiry would come in, or we'd get wind of someone, make that phone call. Probably you don't get through straight away, fine. Instantly follow it up with an email. And then just try again. And then on the key thing is to try and do that as soon as possible after they engage with you or with your brand. So if an inquiry comes in, try to respond to it ASAP. If it's an email that comes in, try to get that reply email out to them straight away, because that's when they're in the frame of mind, when they're thinking actively about you. If you wait and send it the following day, then their mind is probably in a different place by then, and they have to remind themselves why they sent you the email in the first place. You will be acutely aware of what you're doing in your business, but they might have just sent the email to you on a whim and it's not front of mind for them. If you wait to follow up on that. And then, you know, given the fact that our sales value is a little bit higher, we lean more towards getting people on the phone, or now we do Zoom meetings with people as soon as we possibly can. That's a key thing. So that face-to-face or on the phone rather than an email. I think that's another key benefit, a key tool that you can use. Just, you know, you can get so much more out of a conversation with someone. You can get a lot more about what they're feeling and why they're reaching out to your product, which in turn allows you to learn. But also they get far more feeling about your enthusiasm for your product and everything like that, which is a massive positive in a sales environment.
Right. And how long would roughly one of these, one of these sales processes last?
Yeah. So from initial inquiry to money in the bank, order in, we average around about 3 or 4 months. So it's because it's quite an involved decision for a dental practice to switch their software. It's therefore on a little bit more towards the longer side. But in terms of each of the individual steps, typically you'll find we found that we had that first conversation would probably be about half an hour, and that's a good time for an initial conversation. You don't want it to go on too long because they'll then end up having a lot more follow-on questions after they've thought about it. So keeping that first conversation to around half an hour really helps because they get all the information they need right now about you. You've instilled in them enthusiasm about whatever you're trying to sell. So they're now, then this sounds really good. This is a great idea. I want to pursue this more. Then in a subsequent demo, maybe a full demo of your product, if it's involved enough to require a full demo or a subsequent call, that's the point at which you want to go into more detail. Allowing that little bit of time period between the first and second call of a day, 2 days, 3 days, whatever, just allows them to really think about it a little bit more after you've given them that initial enthusiasm. So they can ask much more pointed and direct questions, which allows you to overcome any objections they might have more completely in that second, more intensive call. And then after that intensive call, it's just follow up, chase, follow up, chase, follow up, chase, follow up, chase, follow up, chase until they sign.
Brilliant. And that kind of brings me on to my next question, which is something that's really interesting about your business compared to most of the founders I've interviewed on the show before, which is that there's a lot of talk, obviously, about whether you should be selling a vitamin or a painkiller. In your case, it's kind of neither, right? I mean, you're closer to a heart transplant in a sense, in that, you know, it can improve their quality of life massively. But if it goes wrong, then their business is basically dead, at least for a while.
Completely. And that is that always has been a very big challenge for us from a sales perspective. The level of convincing, so to speak, that you need to do is so much harder because they're having to totally reshape their business to fit your product in. But that's a unique challenge, and everyone's product is going to fit into a different scenario. Is it a pill? Is it a vitamin? Or is it more fundamental?
When it comes to the objections that you had to handle around that, was there anything that you think you did particularly well or particularly badly that maybe other people who are in maybe not the exact same situation but a similar situation can learn from?
Yeah, one of the key things that I would always say is aim to under-promise and over-deliver. The fastest way for you to lose credibility is to overpromise and underdeliver. And as a founder, especially someone with a more of a technical leaning, it's very easy to see some objections in a sales pipeline and go, okay, I can fix those. I can sort those things out. Yes, that can be put into the product or this, that, and the other. If you go down that route very quickly, it snowballs to the point at which it's not sustainable. And I'm talking over the course of having, let's say, 2 or 3 conversations, it can snowball out to the point where you've inferred, not committed to, but inferred to people that, oh yeah, you can fix it by changing the product or something like that. And then they get very disappointed when you don't deliver it, even though you never said you would. So just be very cautious about what you say and about the direction you're going in. I think that's something that, you know, I early on definitely overpromised, and we just then didn't quite deliver. And it's a lot better, I think, to manage expectations early on. Because then, you know, you don't have to recover from that a relationship from their disappointment.
Right. And was there any particular way in which you managed to do that, to manage those expectations? Or is that something just people have to figure out?
Yes. So we have a very comprehensive, you know, running a whole business off your product means that your product is very, the surface area of your product is very large. So the early days, there were many things that we did not do in the product at all. We didn't have feature A, feature B, feature C, or anything like that. So when asked, can it have feature A? And feature A is something that the market already has. So it's, all of your competitors have got it, but because you're a younger product, you don't. You just go, okay, yeah, no, we're definitely planning on putting that in. It is on our pipeline. we are a small dynamic team, you know, a younger company. The benefit of us is coming on for the journey, but we're not going to take you to the end of your journey tomorrow. So, you know, you're selling the ability to come along with, you know, with you to enjoy that. But at the same time, you're instilling in them the idea that, hang on, these things are going to take us quite a while to build. And especially if you're selling to non-technical people, they just don't have a concept of how long it takes to build software features.
Brilliant. So what I want to move on from slightly there now is, you obviously, you were growing well. I mean, you know, especially in this kind of industry, building a business and acquiring customers is a long, slow slog that takes a long time, even when you're doing everything absolutely perfectly. But it sounds like, reading between the lines, that things were pretty difficult and you weren't growing maybe as fast as you wanted to. And that kind of hit an inflection point at some point. Do you want to talk me through kind of what happened there?
Yeah. So at some point, you're going to have to see in your business that you've got to take the plunge and the investment and step away from solely doing founder sales. So I think one of the key things we did, and when we started to see a little bit of momentum gain, was when we hired our first full-time salesperson. That came at around about the 70 to 80 practice mark, customer mark. So, you know, relatively early. But that definitely assisted in getting the sales rate increased. It's just someone out there that's available all day and every day to respond to people promptly, quickly, and so on and so forth. So that made a big difference to us. There was a lot of... it's challenging, though, when you, as a founder, can see that you can probably do it slightly better than that salesperson. But you just got to be aware that you just got to step back at some point and push into running a sales team as opposed to purely trying to do founder sales, because founder sales will never be able to be 100% of your focus. You'll always be focused on other things as well. And I think it's key to make sure that at the right time you take that step away from doing that and from micromanaging the sales process. Make sure, though, you've got all the data you need to ensure that everything's going in the right direction.
Sure. Now, I always love to encourage people, because I think that's a very common thing that happens, is that technical founders, especially if they have a bit of cash in the bank, they're very eager to hire a salesperson, and they do that way too early. Because, I mean, there are two things, in my opinion, that make it, or two reasons why it is very important that founders do sales in the very early stages. First off, you just have the fact that if you're not talking to customers, then you're not learning about what works, what features they want, what objections they have, and, you know, you're just not going to build a very good product, probably. And then the second thing is obviously that if you haven't done sales yourself and you hire someone who says they're a good salesperson straight out of the gate and they're not doing very well, then you have absolutely no idea whether that's a product problem, whether that's a salesperson problem, or whether it's something completely different that you have no idea about. Right? You have no idea, basically, what you can't track or manage the performance of that salesperson. So how did you know that the 70 to 80 customer mark was the right time to get someone on board?
That's a really, really good question. And I would totally agree that it's far too easy to go out and hire a salesperson too early. And whilst I'm saying that we did it probably a little bit too late, if you do hire a salesperson as a founder, I personally believe that you always want to be involved in the sales process forever going forward. Choose a lead, take a deal, and work it all the time. And I still do that now. We've got, you know, multiple people in sales, but I still take the odd deal and work it from beginning to end myself to ensure that you're always connected to that sales process. You can learn about any friction within your sales process by doing that. And like you said, you can understand, what are the issues? Is it a salesperson? Is it a pipeline issue, or is it a product issue? And by being connected. So yeah, always maintain that direct connection to sales yourself. In terms, when hiring a salesperson, the one thing they should be good at doing is selling, and selling themselves is part of that. So if they don't do a good job of selling themselves, they're probably not a good salesperson, but that does mean that you could potentially mishire. It's one of the hardest areas to probably hire, especially if you don't have that sales experience yourself. So in terms of why at the 60 to 70 mark, for me, it was, we should have probably made the call at around the 40 to 50 mark. Maybe a little bit later. So we left it a little bit too long, but it's better to err on that side than the other way around. And it was the point at which I just wasn't following up anywhere near as well as I should have been, because I was being distracted or just not doing a good enough job. And I felt that I was letting myself down in terms of sales. So I knew that I needed to offload some of that responsibility.
Brilliant. And how did you go about making that first hire? Then I hear kind of competing advice. I've been through this a couple of times myself and have my own opinions, but one popular way of hiring your first salespeople, I think this comes back probably, I think, to something Stelly said as well, is to hire a couple at once and see who works out. How did you go about doing it, and what advice would
I think trying to hire two salespeople at once, 100% I agree with that advice. Massive caveat that is if you can afford that luxury. We were not in that boat. We could not afford to go and take a punt on two. We could not afford to take a punt on two sales people at the time. We knew that we didn't have the pipeline coming in to feed them. It is a lot easier to compare performance against two salespeople. We did get to the point where we had two people closing deals, and it was a lot easier to see issues in your pipeline and how you were structuring deals and where you could then go and work with individuals to improve various bottlenecks. Sure. And when you have two people, it is easier. One of the easy ways then of doing it early on is make sure you then stay involved in the sales process instead of 100% of the time and going to 0% once you hire that first person, is go from 100% of the sales to maybe getting involved with them quite a lot early on and then stepping back, but still being involved in a reasonable amount so that you do have two salespeople. You've got yourself and you've got the salesperson. Bear in mind though, that whilst the salesperson might be slightly better at you at selling, you have a massive advantage by being a founder. So founder sales are a lot easier.
Sure. And I have a couple of follow-up questions. And if I'm getting into too much detail, or if this is something you don't feel comfortable talking about, then obviously just say. But I guess one question is just, did you hire a salesperson who basically came in and took on the role of, managing the full sales process from the very first contact to actually closing the deal? Or did you bring someone in and have them, for example, handling more of the sales development side, so the lead qualification, and you were still doing a lot of the closing, for example? Let's start there, maybe.
Yeah, no. So they came in and were thrown at the whole pipeline. One of the other mistakes as we grew a little bit that we made is when our sales got too busy for that one full-time salesperson, we hired another full-time closer. So we had two closers that were each managing the whole pipeline top to bottom that was split 50-50. That, what I come to appreciate, that was not the right approach to do. It's much more beneficial in a longer sales pipeline. Like, we have 3 to 4 months to have a sales development role and then a closer role, which is what we've got now, and it's working so much better for us. Initially, what the kind of balance that we had when we hired the first salesperson was that they would take over essentially it was the only person in sales. We weren't really doing any marketing at this point. We didn't have anyone in marketing. They were managing essentially the full pipeline, the full process, but we came up with quite a nice deal that they would just wheel me in when they felt it was appropriate. So I was always there as a tool that the salesperson can use to say, hey, it'd be really great if you could have a conversation with these people, or I think this is better suited for you. Here's it's a deal that you can sort out. Or I would just say, yeah, I'm going to work with that one. So we worked collaboratively for quite a bit, and that worked really well for us, because any questions that a salesperson might not have the feeling of how the business is going to be able to answer straight away, you as a founder can just go, yep, no problem, or no, we can't do that, but you can do this, that, and the other. So having that combo approach worked really well for us when you don't have the ability to ramp up a full sales team with multiple people top to bottom.
Brilliant. And I'd like to just for listeners who maybe don't understand inherently why having splitting up the pipeline into maybe SDR and AE works better for you, do you mind giving a quick explanation of why that turned out to be beneficial?
Absolutely. I think you can distill that down quite quickly. So the way that we work now in 2020 is we have marketing, and marketing's job is with all of our advertising spend, content marketing, everything like that, is to deliver a contact to the sales team. Marketing in our business is not designed to convert someone to be a paying customer. It's purely designed to convert them to be a lead. And then sales takes that lead and then tries to convert them into being a paying customer. when you've got that, you could have someone that's coming in as a lead that is basically completely ready to buy. And you can have someone that's coming in as a lead that's more of an initial inquiry. They might be looking at something like that. Splitting the concerns allows you to have someone to work purely on that qualification. So if they're just coming in and wondering about this, that, and the other, then they can focus solely on those. And typically speaking, that is a lot more emails, a lot more phone calls that are all much shorter in length. It's just consistency. It's just volume. And then a closer, an AE, will be working with a much smaller number of people, but with many, many more touch points. So they might have 10 emails going backwards and forwards with one of their accounts, prospective accounts, in a week, as opposed to sending 10 accounts, one email a week, which is where an SDR might work. In terms of the benefit of having that separation of concerns is the fact that a SDR is not going to be tied up with really complicated long emails that they need to work on, or long demos, or all of that late sales stuff. So they can just focus on making sure that all of the early stage stuff is happening consistently. Inversely, a closer might have a whole bunch of really high value work that's going to take an enormous amount of time to do this week in order to get deals over the final few yards. But that means that they're not then spending that time focusing on the early stage stuff. So what we were finding when we had two closers was you'd get cycles. So you'd have a month where one sales guy was absolutely smashing it and closing everything. But in order to achieve that, in order to get all of that closing all at once, they essentially were not looking at all at their middle of or top of the funnel. That meant that the following month, they basically had no one coming down towards the end of the funnel. They were having to go right back up to the top of the funnel and start working them. So they'd have a month of really good stuff, then a month of fairly mediocre sales whilst they brought people through the funnel. And then the third month would then be another good month because they brought all these people through the funnel. So by separating out those two concerns, you get into that nice consistency.
Brilliant. And I'm conscious of time, so I don't want to spend too much more time on this, but I do want to talk quickly about how you've been responding and adapting to the current situation we find ourselves in. It's the middle of May 2020 right now. So obviously COVID-19 has been going on in the UK for two and a half months at this point, I think. It's pretty serious. Businesses are affected. I imagine a lot of dental practices aren't even open except for emergency stuff. How have you been managing it?
So yeah, I mean, dental practices in the UK are completely shut essentially. Not even for emergencies. Those are all being referred to specialist COVID-19 centers. So in that respect, it's obviously hard for the industry because everyone's on complete shutdown. What we found from a sales perspective was, so the lockdown in the UK started on the 23rd of March, Monday the 23rd of March. What we found was people that were in our sales pipeline coming towards the end of the pipeline that prior to lockdown, i.e. they entered the top of the pipeline with a normal world buying mentality. Overwhelmingly, those guys just slammed on the brakes and were like, oh my God, there's so much uncertainty now. I don't want to be making this decision now. So they've kicked it off until August or whatever. So we basically found that our sales pipeline just stopped at the beginning of the lockdown. What was then really interesting is we've had more and more new inquiries coming in, because I think it's important that no one, especially the kind of target audience here, is typically we're all disruptors, we're innovators, we're coming in and we are the new way of doing things. Whatever we're selling, it's newer than what exists out there already. And I think the coronavirus is absolutely giving rise to the opportunity for people to adopt and take up new things. So we've seen, we compete predominantly against legacy on-premises systems. That's what the majority of dentists use. It's this coronavirus and having people having to socially distance, potentially work from home and stuff like that, means that, you know, it's an absolute ripe opportunity for people to review what we've got and what we're doing. So we've seen since the lockdown, a whole new set of buyers come in and try engage with us and see what we've got to offer. I mean, it also helps the fact that instead of being in surgery 8 hours a day treating patients, they're now not So they have far more time and opportunity to speak to us. So we've actually seen that whilst we had a wobbly start to April, because it was just after the beginning of the lockdown, second half of April and into May has seen sales significantly kick up, because people are just, you know, we've just got that opportunity to disrupt. And I think there's a huge case to be made that disruptive technologies are going to come out of coronavirus quite well. I mean, just look at what Zoom has managed to achieve. It's renormalized the fact that you can have a meeting without going to visit someone else. Far more people now are accepting of that.
Yeah, brilliant. And have you adapted any of, obviously the value that you provide, the pain that you solve hasn't really changed at all, but have you adapted any of the language, the way that you're selling or pitching or marketing your product to the change in situation for people?
Yeah, we're being cognizant of the fact that, you know, we can't deliver the same services around this time period. So there's we're giving a few, like a couple of free months discount whilst people are on lockdown. We're acknowledging the fact that they're not getting full value of the product on day one after they sign, because their practices aren't open. We're getting a few other, there's subtle content changes in terms of what we're putting out from marketing. But overwhelmingly, we're working on the assumption that, look, dentistry still has to happen in the future. It's not like, okay, that's it, dentistry's finished. Dentistry still has to happen. We will get back to, nearly everyone's customers will get back to a normal. And it's just purely about pointing out and instilling in them that this is the best tool for the new normal. So you're working on the presumption of it going back to normal, but you're, just hammering home why your product is, or our product is the right one to fit the need now.
Awesome. I'll let you go in a second, but there is one more question that if you have time, I would love to jump into really quickly, which is your approach is not that uncommon when you're selling to SMEs, to small and medium-sized businesses, but pretty uncommon in SaaS in general. You charge a recurring price, but you also have an upfront onboarding cost. I imagine a lot of people out there are sitting there and thinking, well, charging people upfront to be onboarded, that seems like it's going to be a conversion rate killer. Why not just up the yearly price instead?
A great question. I think there's a number of factors here. First of all, you look at, it's not totally uncommon in SaaS. You go and buy HubSpot, for instance, and they have an onboarding fee as well as their recurring. There are, so it's not just a pure MMR. And the other side of that I think it's really industry specific. Selling, your business management system to dental practices, they've been used to paying for onboarding services. So it was kind of like a little bit industry defined. In addition to that, I think it all really depends on the service you provide. If you're going to be providing a huge amount of value in your onboarding, then there makes no sense at all in not charging for it. So we do training, consulting training sessions with staff at the dental practice, which typically were face-to-face. Now they're all online. We're providing that training to them. That costs time, staff time, and so on and so forth. And in addition to that, there's huge amounts of data migration that we have to do. So we provide a very, very bespoke handholding service. So I think therefore it's easier for us to have the concept of charging for it. Typically also, we charge about $2,000 onboarding. But at the same time, I don't think anyone should shy away in a sales-based process from charging some sort of onboarding, some sort of transition. If you're running a sales-based process, you're already invested with a human touch, which makes it a lot easier for you to justify what you're doing. If you're in a self-sign-up fashion, if you're in a self-sign-up product and marketing is having to deliver your conversions, then yeah, an onboarding fee would probably kill your conversion rate. But the moment you get a salesperson in there to explain what the value prop of your onboarding payment is, I think there's no harm in running with it. And with anything in sales and pricing, go experiment. Go and don't just assume that it will kill your conversion. If you charge a little bit of onboarding and it doesn't kill your conversion, then hey, great. Not only that, but you can invest more in making sure that customer is really engaged and integrated with your product, which is going to massively help against churn.
Awesome. I think that's the perfect place and the perfect piece of very useful advice that we can leave this on. Where can people go and find out more about you and about Dentally? And I appreciate that there probably aren't going to be very many dentists listening to this, so they'll be checking out Dentally more out of curiosity than anything else. But is there anywhere else that you'd recommend people go and look at, whether that's a blog, Twitter, just some links to some sales stuff that you found useful, whatever you want?
No, absolutely. More than happy to take emails or anything like that. I'm happy to answer questions on sales topics or provide little bits of advice. Don't promise to be very quick at getting back to you, but I'm nick@dentally.co. So people can get a hold of me there. In terms of other online tools, I think that there's a lot of our little strategies and everything like that come from Close's blog. This is Stelly's blog. If you distill that into, you know, don't take everything there as gospel, because obviously they have to work towards a much wider audience than just your industry. But there's some really, really good gold on there in terms of how just to get your sales process working. And that's written by salespeople for salespeople, so it's bang on. And then in the final bit of thing is, yeah, just speak to people.
That's brilliant advice to end it on. And for anyone who's listening and wants to check out some of that Close stuff, I agree there's some great tactics there, especially once you get to that 10K MRR mark and you start systematizing your sales a bit more. And for the early stage stuff, we actually had one of Close's team, James Urie, on the podcast last year. I think it's maybe a series 2, episode 3 or 4, I want to say, which was great as well. So a good one to check out if you're interested in that kind of thing. Nick, thanks so much for joining me and talking to me and helping everyone out.
No problem.
I hope you have a good one. Yeah, have a great rest of the day. Thanks. That's all for this episode of the Sales for Founders podcast. Before you go, would you take a quick second to share the podcast with a friend or leave a rating or review in the podcast app of your choice? And remember, if you're struggling with sales, head on over to salesforfounders.com and sign up for a free newsletter full of actionable sales advice. See you next week.